You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. Efa Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about Budget Day today and the suspensions of three Te Pāti Māori MPs over the Treaty Principles Bill Hucker. For International Desk, I spoke to Professor of International Law at Australian National University, Donald Rothwell, about the ongoing famine in Gaza due to Israeli blockades and the response under international law. And ahead of Budget 2025 being announced, I spoke to University of Auckland Associate Professor Susan St. John and Isaac Gunson from the Child Poverty Action Group about the potential social impact of the budget. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
Kia ora. For my interview with Julie Ferry for this week's City Counselling, we discussed the issue of littering in Auckland, including the rise of illegal dumping. We also talk about Mayor Wayne Brown's interest in transforming Auckland into the premier tech city of New Zealand. As well, I interviewed Chief Scientist at TOA and founder of Te Pūnaha Matatini about Sean Hendy about the recent global pandemic treaty adopted by the World Health Organization.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pā tuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai dāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879, kāua e wari wari I ahiana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō he pakehiri roki roki mārunga I te pae tuku tuku o erirangi pōho mi haere ki 95BFM e rakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Today is Budget Day, the day the government releases their spending plans for the next year. The embargo on the budget lifts at 2 p.m. However, there have already been several pre-budget spending announcements. These include boosts in funding for defence, urgent care and school attendance initiatives. Earlier this week, the debate on the Privileges Committee report into the Treaty Principles Haka, led by Te Pāti Māori, was deferred. The report recommended the suspension of co-leaders Rawiri Waititi and Debbie Ngārewa-Packer for 3 weeks and MP Hana Rāwhiti Maipi Clark for 1 week. Opposition MPs have raised concerns that because the debate has been deferred, the Te Pāti Māori co-leaders may not be back in time to vote on the budget. For our weekly catch-up with Labour's Carmel Cipollone, I asked about all of these topics. I started by asking what she expected to be announced in today's budget, particularly in the vein of growth.
Well, I think whatever they do today, they'll try to spin it as growth, but I'm not confident that will be the case. They really need to do three things in Budget 2025 if it's genuinely going to turn things around for New Zealanders. Firstly, they need to properly fund our frontline public services. Secondly, they need to provide a credible answer to how the government's going to fund all of its promises, and that should not be at the expense of working women. And thirdly, they need to show that they have a plan to invest in our future, to rebuild our ageing school, hospitals, public homes and infrastructure, to create jobs, upskill our workers and raise wages and living standards.
What do the constituents you represent want to see in today's budget?
It is very clear in my electorate and for the people that I got into Parliament to represent. The biggest challenge is the cost of living, but there are other associated challenges with that. It is the cost of housing, it is the cost of healthcare, it is the fact that so many people, particularly in Auckland, have lost jobs because of the state of the economy, And so it all goes back to cost of living, but there are surrounding challenges that can't be ignored.
So far, the big pre-budget announcements have been on defence, school attendance and urgent care. What do you make of these initiatives?
Well, they don't reflect the real need that we're seeing out there. I mean, health, sure, you know, there's something in that, but that's urgent care. What about primary care? You'd much rather that people were getting access to the primary care health services and not having to go in after hours to seek out after hours care or urgent care. And so I certainly don't think that the pre-budget announcements reflect what the constituents I represent are wanting most.
How concerned are you about what the government will have to cut to fund its budget?
Well, we're mostly concerned that National is cutting women's pay to balance their budget. And budgets are a choice. You know, build for the future or cut. National is cutting and women are paying. You know, National has found hundreds of millions of dollars for tobacco companies, and they've found $2.9 billion for tax breaks for landlords, and they paid for tax cuts that were unaffordable, and they're taking it from women's back pockets.
The Greens released their own alternative budget. Hipkin says it's unrealistic but is willing to support some of its ideas. What ideas are these, and what about their budget is unrealistic?
Look, I think, you know, just at a high level, often the Greens are known for putting all of what they would want to see on the table. And they aren't, because they're never the political party in government that have responsibility for balancing the books, then they probably don't need to turn their mind to that fiscal responsibility and affordability to the same extent that a political party like National does. And so there, of course, would be some consideration for what the Greens put forward, but they're never, ever going to get the full extent of their budget because there simply just is not enough money to go around. Also, it's about shared priorities and making sure that we're prioritising those things that are of, you know, of importance to both political parties if you're in a position where you're in coalition.
Do you think that the suspensions handed out to Te Pāti Māori were reasonable?
Not at all. I think that Chris Hipkins did a great speech in the House on this the other day. There is no precedent for what's being given out here in terms of the punishment and the extent of time that they are expected to be suspended. It is mean-spirited by the government, and they just simply are not following what rules have been set in the past. No one is saying that what Te Pāti Māori did is exactly within the rules. And in fact, Chris Hipkins has been really clear that there's a level of punishment that is required. I hate using that word, but in terms of the period of time that they might be suspended, 1 to 2 days, not 3 weeks. This is ridiculous, and we simply could not support what they were saying.
Was it right for the government to have suspended debate on the suspensions until after Budget Day?
Well, it's very interesting as to why this went on. That is the question. Why did they make the decision to suspend? There seems to be some internal murmurings there. I'm not sure if they entirely agreed with Luxon coming out and saying that he wasn't taking it to caucus, that it was his decision and this is how it's going to be. So how that decision came about in the first place is interesting to contemplate. But secondly, there's still the potential that they're going to lock the Te Pāti Māori out from being able to vote against the budget, because we have quite a fulsome debate after the budget is introduced to the House that goes on for a period of weeks. And so at what point will the three members from Te Pāti Māori be back? Will they be able to vote for or against the budget? I mean, there are real democratic issues here. When you take out half of a party's members around a time when quite a crucial vote has to be cast.
ACT MP Parmjeet Palmer requested advice on imprisonment for the MPs. Is that at all appropriate?
Completely inappropriate. Parmjeet Palmer is inappropriate. the lengths that that woman will go to, and the level of conservatism, and also just, you know, her general attitude towards Māori, I have to say, is highly disconcerting. And this particular thing that she was pushing for is recognition of that.
In general, should tikanga be considered more seriously by the House?
I think that there's a discussion to be had here, and I think it was actually the National Party or Shane Jones or someone that put up that there should be a discussion around tikanga, and that Adrian Rudafia would be a good person to lead it. He has been the Speaker before. There should be a discussion about what it looks like in the House so that there's some clarity around that.
That was Labour's Kamau Sepuloni on Budget Day 2025 and the suspensions of Te Pāti Māori MPs over the Treaty Principles Bill Haka.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Last year, Auckland Council removed 30% of bins from public places with the hopes of saving about $9.5 million over an eight-year period. While the council didn't foresee an increase in littering, last week Stuff published an article sharing the frustrations of residents who observed a growing litter problem in council parks. Illegal dumping has also been on the rise across Auckland. With more than 1,300 reports per month, the cost of retrieving illegally dumped items is about $2.7 million every year and rising. Also, Mayor Wayne Brown has announced that he wants to see Auckland become the premier tech city of New Zealand to boost our global influence and reputation, calling on the government to establish the new Advanced Technology Institute here, which he says could play a key role in guiding new startups so ideas don't die on the vine. Beginning with the problem of rubbish in Auckland, I started by asking Julie Ferry if she believed the removal of bins was to blame for increased littering.
It doesn't seem like it probably is, to be honest. All the data that we're getting shows that there's no spike in complaints or requests for services to remove litter around places where we have previously removed rubbish bins. There was a very specific issue around Music Point, which was the one that was reported on. And it looks like there that the rubbish is due to antisocial behaviour, parties and people leaving behind dog poo bags. So that's being specifically addressed. I don't think they're called park rangers anymore, but the person who used to be called the park ranger for that area has picked that up, made some comments to media and clarified that there's going to be some extra work there to just get on top of it. So it doesn't look like there is a link there at all.
Were the costs of litter patrols and other measures to remove increased volumes of litter accounted for in the savings Auckland Council expects to achieve by the removal of public bins?
Yeah, I think so, because the expectation was that it wouldn't necessarily create any extra need for that stuff. So in some cases, there have been bins removed where there was only one bin, but in most cases it's actually been where there were, say, two bins quite close together, that kind of thing. So what people can do, though, if they're worried about a particular location, is they can raise that with their local board. And local boards have been working with the parks and community facilities people who are in charge of the bins. So that is something, if people have a particular location, I really strongly encourage them to talk to their local board. You can work out which local board is yours through the council website. But it doesn't look like there is a link there. There's also an important difference between littering and illegal dumping. Illegal dumping tends to be quite different. We're talking about larger items, things like mattresses, pieces of furniture, sometimes large amounts of household rubbish, you know, often in bags and stuff like that. And there appears to be absolutely no link at all, definitely, between illegal dumping and where rubbish bins have been removed. People weren't using those rubbish bins to put those kinds of items in anyway. But we do have a broader illegal dumping problem. We've had it for years. And people are really strongly encouraged to ring 0800 no dump to log illegal dumping, because that's something that once there's a little bit, it tends to attract more and more and more. And we do put cameras up in hotspots to catch people, and we do prosecute people who we catch.
Yeah, as you've mentioned, illegal dumping has been on the rise across Auckland. You've already mentioned that you've got cameras set up in some areas. What are some of the other ways Auckland Council has been responding to this problem?
So there's two ways, right? One is to reduce it happening in the first place. And so we have now the inorganic system where you can book to have your items picked up. I've just recently booked for my area. And that's coming up in late July for my street. And that's a free service. You can access that once a year and they will come around and take away stuff. The reality for a lot of people is that they don't necessarily have room to store those things in between inorganic collections. So, you know, I have some sympathy there that often it is hard to know how do I get rid of a mattress or whatever. So there's a range of initiatives in that sort of waste management space around connecting people with community recycling centres, and we're building more and more of those around the region. And also thinking about, so for example, you can take paint cans, which is something you can't put in the rubbish. You've got lots of paint cans, you can take them to most resines and they will accept them for recycling. There's other places like that. I think some might attend to take big pieces of polystyrene. So there's sort of a bit of a network being created around giving people options around those kinds of items. One of the things to think about is when you're buying a new thing, how do I get rid of the old thing? So, for example, if you're buying a new mattress, these days a lot of people will buy a new mattress, they'll get it delivered straight to their house. Through companies like Ecosa, and they will actually take your old mattress away as well, but you probably need to just check that they're going to do that, be ready for them to do that. So that's another way that we can sort of prevent in the first place. And also I should say that if people do have items and they don't know how to get rid of them, you can contact council for advice as well. So that can be another useful option. But then in terms of stopping people from, you know, catching people who are doing it to stop them from doing it again. As I said, we do have cameras in hotspots. Those cameras actually move around, and we have the 0800 no dump. And also in terms of some of those stuff, particularly where we're seeing large numbers, there'll actually be some forensic investigation that tries to work out where those have come from so that we can prosecute that person. Because it's likely if it's something like a large dump of tyres, that it's actually probably somebody commercially doing that. It's unlikely someone would have a, you know, big bunch of tyres that they've put on the back of their personal truck that they've been keeping in their personal home and they've gone and dumped them. It'll probably be part of somebody's business. And that, you know, should be part of your business is how do I responsibly dispose of any waste that I have, rather than making money off dumping stuff in public parks.
Moving on to my next topic, Mayor Wayne Brown has announced that he wants to see Auckland become the premier tech city of New Zealand. What forms of funding is Auckland Council considering to enact these plans?
So I'm not sure of any particular additional funds, but there is happening at the moment, happening later in the year, is Auckland Startup Week, which is a new initiative from Tātaki Auckland Unlimited, which is part of council, and that's happening in October. So there'll be funding for that. I can't tell you how much, but not because it's secret, just because I don't know. And the website for that's going to be launching at the end of June. More information will be available for the media about that in July. There's also Grid Auckland, which is the innovation hub down in Wynyard Quarter that council has supported for 10 years now. That's sort of a co-working space that encourages startups and sort of works in that sort of tech and innovation ecosystem so that people can learn from each other and things like that. So there's two key locations for that. There's a startup hub in Pakenham Street West, and then there's a scale-up hub, which is the next step, then at 12 Madden Street, and that's worked with 140 businesses, over 900 employees, so that's been really successful in terms of that, you know, tech space, supporting people in the startup. So one of the things that I think the Mayor's keen to focus on now is also how do we approach some of those bigger players to be based in Auckland as well. And so we'll just sort of have to see how that unfolds. One of the things there is also that Tātaki Auckland Unlimited, we made a decision late last year to restructure where the economic development function for council sits. And it has been sitting with Tātaki, and it's actually now going to be coming in-house to Auckland Council. That's going to roll out over the next little while. So that'll have a bearing on how that tech stuff is supported by council in the future, and probably a little bit too early to say what that exactly is going to look like, but potentially quite exciting. Also how they might work with local boards to think about, okay, are there particular locations where it might make sense to bid for, say, data centre to be located and things like that, not necessarily just looking entirely at the city centre, but looking regionally.
What are some of the benefits Auckland Council is hoping to gain by establishing this strategic alliance with the tech centre in terms of global and national growth, I suppose?
So, I mean, we know that that's sort of one of the future industries, if you like. I mean, it's an industry now, but it's also one that's going to continue to develop into the future. And so it's the kind of thing that attracts investment, attracts jobs, attracts people with skill and talent. And the more of all of that that we have in our city, the better for the city as a whole, economically, but also as a cool place to live. These are people who will support our hospitality businesses, our service industries. You know, they'll live here and work here and make a great contribution to the city on a range of factors. But also we know that there's a lot of benefits from what's called agglomeration, where you bring together and you have sort of an intensity of people doing similar things, and then they learn from each other, they help each other to excel. There's a sort of cross-pollination of ideas and that kind of stuff, which has a broader benefit as well. To use a sports metaphor, which Shane would use, I imagine, every week, when Tiger Woods was just hitting hole-in-ones all over the place and stuff, it actually lifted the whole performance of a lot of other golfers as well. So it's that kind of thing, to use a very ham-fisted golf metaphor. And of course, Tiger Woods is highly problematic, just putting that out there.
At this stage, has there been any expression of support from the government for this plan, especially in relation to this new Advanced Technology Institute that Mayor Wen Brown was hoping the government would establish in Auckland?
I think, if I remember correctly, I think that the Advanced Technology Institute, my understanding is that basically sort of bids are in now to say, hey, you should base one here. And so that's what we're doing, is we're going, hey, we're putting our hand up. Auckland's a great place to do this. And it's probably too soon to say whether central government's going to go, yep, we agree, because I think they're in a process of sort of accepting bids and stuff on that. I think it's a no-brainer. Obviously, it should happen in Auckland. Cities are amazing innovation engines, and this is the natural place to do that.
How does this priority align with the council's commitment to other key issues like climate action and tackling the cost of living for Aucklanders?
Yeah, so I think one of the things we know is that tech jobs can be reasonably high wage. Not all of them, but that potentially, you know, helps with some of the cost of living stuff for those specific people, which potentially has some knock-on effects as well. But I think the climate piece is really interesting, because we know that some of the stuff is actually quite hard on the climate. Like, we often think of tech as being naturally quite green, but not necessarily. And so I think it's really important that as we progress this kind of thing, we do keep that in the back of our mind. How do we actually do this in a way that is sustainable? In New Zealand, we tend to be quite blasé about the use of electricity, because so much of our electricity is renewable energy from hydro. But we know that, you know, some of these data centres require massive amounts of energy. What we're seeing with the increased use of AI and the frivolous use of AI as well, in ways that are actually really bad for the environment, that's starting to become a thing that people are aware of. I mean, I think 2 years, 3 years ago, when people started making images of John Oliver marrying a cabbage, I don't think any of us had, or it might have been a lettuce, anyway, I don't think any of us had any idea that that was, you know, sucking so much energy and actually to the point of being a problem. And now we do know that. We know better, we need to do better. So that is something I think that we need to be really mindful of. And I'm really interested in how, if we get this advanced tech centre, we can actually use that to support a lot of climate innovation. So, for example, the adoption of tech in the agriculture industry, that could significantly reduce emissions and things like that. There's some really cool stuff happening there. As it happens, council operates a bunch of farming activities through our regional parks, so there's a potential there for us to pilot some of this stuff, to test it out, working with scientists as well as the tech industry, and then, you know, help the industry to scale it for use on commercial farms. So there's some real opportunities there, but we need to consciously do them. We can't just expect them to happen without some strategic input.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on the problem of rubbish and illegal dumping in Auckland, as well as Auckland Council's hope for the city to become the tech centre of New Zealand.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Calling all artists and music industry professionals. The annual New Zealand Music Month Summit is back, presented by the New Zealand Music Commission and the Music Managers Forum.
A jam-packed day full of advice and discussions on live music performance, promotion and touring for artists and music industry professionals at any level.
The New Zealand Music Month Summit 2025, this Saturday at the Tuning Fork. Register now for your free ticket at moshtix.co.nz.
Start your engines and get ready to rock.
Tamaki Makaurau legends Vuram have just released their new album, Something Good Is Happening.
Vuram are as good as ever, with a brand new record that delivers on their iconic brand of fuzzy, heartfelt bangers.
Something Good Is Happening, the new album from Vuram, is out on Flying Nun Records and available wherever good music is found.
It's a Dream Matariki combo. Rhea Hall and the Auckland Philharmonia link up to perform Rhea's songs with an epic orchestral soundscape. And we've got tickets to give away to our B-card whānau. So stay dialed in to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Auckland Philharmonia presents Matariki with Rhea Hall. Auckland Town Hall, Thursday, June 19th. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Yes, I am the rhythm selection. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dobby and the selectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man, from rock steady to roots reggae, beatbox sound to hip hop, dub style, true to the latest dancehall vibes. Yeah, man, the rhythm selection. Boy, the rhythm selection. Why? The rhythm selection. Boy, from 9 to 11 and 95 FM. Dobby Dam, yes, select us. The rhythm selection.
Five, four, three, two, one.
International Desk are go.
International pressure is mounting against Israel for the 11-week-long and ongoing blockade of aid into Gaza. The few aid trucks that have been let into Gaza have not been distributed, according to the United Nations. Global experts are warning of a famine in the region, with over 14,000 infants and young children at immediate risk. It comes as cases against Israel in the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court for various violations of international law remain ongoing. Arrest warrants from the Criminal Court against senior Israeli officials, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant, remain active. I spoke to Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University Law School about the aid blockade and response in international law. I started by asking him to explain what has caused the ongoing famine in Gaza.
A ceasefire was negotiated between Israel and Hamas, and that commenced in the middle of February. And that ceasefire allowed for some normalcy in terms of the provision of humanitarian aid, food and water into Gaza. However, once that ceasefire ended in the middle of March, Israel reimposed a very significant blockade on Gaza. And so that blockade was in place for approximately 9 weeks. And so over that period of time, whatever supplies of food and water and medical equipment has inevitably been diminished, bearing in mind that the reserves of food and water and medical supplies and equipment was already very compromised. So over the last week, everything has very much reached a tipping point in terms of the United Nations and the humanitarian community seeking to bring to the attention of the United Nations Security Council and to all of the relevant countries involved in the situation that the humanitarian situation for the civilian population in Gaza had really become intolerable. And that really culminated earlier this week with the head of the United Nations Humanitarian Agency saying that unless supplies were immediately provided to the population in Gaza, there was the prospect of, I think, 14,000 babies dying within 48 hours.
This leads well into my next question, which is, what can international law do to bring an end to the famine?
There's multiple instances here of international law being violated. And the starting point for that is that whilst it's not really in dispute that Israel is able to defend itself against ongoing attacks from Hamas, the way in which it defends itself must be consistent with international law. And here we're particularly talking about international humanitarian law. And international humanitarian law has a very clear rule which says that starvation of the civilian population cannot be used as a method of warfare. And so all of the evidence points to the fact that this has been a policy conducted by the Israeli government to effectively starve the Palestinian population in Gaza. So that's the international law rule. If we accept on face value from the evidence that this rule is being breached, the next question goes to, well, how can international law here be enforced? Now, we need to always be mindful that there is no international police force that exists in the same way that there is to enforce our criminal laws in New Zealand or in Australia, for example. So when international law is clearly being breached, there are mechanisms under which those who are breaching international law can be held accountable, but how international law can be actively enforced in these situations is very difficult. Under the system established at the end of World War II, the United Nations Charter gave to the United Nations Security Council the ability to take action where there were threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and effectively threats to international peace and security, such as gross violations of international law. But of course, the difficulty with the Security Council being able to respond to enforce international law in this situation is that the United States exercises a veto as a permanent member of the Security Council, and the United States will use that veto to protect any resolutions which are critical of Israel in the Security Council.
Is international law an efficient or even reliable tool to use to bring an end to the famine or war on Gaza more generally?
I think it's part of the toolbox of how states who are concerned about the situation in Gaza, in which they can resort to international law, resort to some of these fundamental principles of international law, which is really what we're talking about, and deploy references to international law in addition to diplomacy, in addition to considering trade sanctions, in addition to considering other measures that can be taken to ultimately apply pressure on, in this case, Israel, to adjust its conduct and bring it into conformity with the expectations that international law has in this particular area. So because international law doesn't have a clear enforcement mechanism, the way to go about using international law in this case is to deploy it as one of the multiple strands of the arguments that can be deployed and developed and engaged with in terms of discourse with Israel, whether it's in capitals such as Wellington or Canberra, or in New York at the United Nations to seek to persuade and make Israeli diplomats and the representatives of Israel well aware of the fact that states find Israel's conduct here to not be in any way consistent with the expectations of a law-abiding international citizen.
You've mentioned the statistic already, but 14,000 young children in Gaza are at immediate risk of starvation. Do you think the impact of the Israeli blockades on children could motivate the world to act?
Well, I think what we've seen over the course of the last few weeks is that the relevant United Nations agencies responsible for the provision of aid and responsible for overseeing the humanitarian response in Gaza, in addition to many other non-governmental organisations who've had a long-standing interest and mandate for engagement in Gaza. And here I'm thinking of agencies such as Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, who have volunteer doctors currently operating in Gaza. They've really sought to highlight the plight of Palestinian children because obviously Palestinian children are the future of Palestine, are the future of a potential Palestinian state. And at one very broad level, if Palestinian children are so significantly harmed by the effects of the aid blockade, that can be argued as evidence of genocide being committed in Gaza by Israel. Now, we need to be mindful of the fact that South Africa has commenced the case in the International Court of Justice against Israel, arguing that Israel's conduct in the early stages of the conflict with Hamas, and here we're talking about 2023 and early 2024, constituted acts of genocide. That case remains ongoing. But when that case comes to be fully heard and determined by the International Court of Justice, which may be a few years away from now, the matters that we're talking about in terms of the effect of the blockade on Palestinian children, I'm fairly confident that will be raised by South Africa as part of its evidence to support its claim that genocide is being conducted in Israel. Now, I will immediately acknowledge that is a very difficult legal argument to make, and there's no suggestion legally that genocide has occurred, but it is clearly a live legal issue that has been debated before international courts at this very moment.
Israel's restrictions on Gaza's borders began before October 7th, 2023. Has this been factored into these discussions at all?
It's really just been a given that Gaza, as an occupied Palestinian territory, is not independent. It's occupied by Israel under the provisions of the Geneva Convention. And even when it hasn't been fully occupied by Israel, it's been completely secured by Israeli military forces. So for much of its past history over the last few decades, movement in and out of the Gaza Strip has been significantly controlled by Israel and by the members of the Israeli Defense Force. It's just that really this blockade, which effectively is what it's been, has been significantly tightened during the course of the Israeli-Hamas conflict since October 2003. And of course, we've been talking about the events effectively from the middle of March to effectively this week. It was so tight in terms of the blockade being imposed that, as we discussed, no aid, no water, no food was permitted into Gaza at all. The only physical movement that was occurring literally into Gaza was the movement of Israeli Defense Forces in and out of the Gaza Strip as they continued their military campaign against Hamas. So the backdrop to this whole situation really has been the blockade, the effects of the blockade, which inevitably for any civilian population which has been dealing with an ongoing military conflict causing enormous displacement of that civilian population. On top of that, there's been this underlying cause of the gradual effects of the blockade wearing down the civilian population in terms of their basics for daily survival.
That was Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University Law School on the ongoing famine in Gaza due to Israeli blockades and the response under international law.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Since COVID-19 shocked the global health system with the impacts of a lack of pandemic preparedness, the World Health Assembly has undertaken intense negotiations to help develop a stronger and more equitable response to future pandemics. Today, I spoke with the chief scientist at TOA and founder of Te Pūnaha Matatini, Sean Hendy, about the pandemic treaty adopted by the World Health Organization and how New Zealand should be preparing for future health crises. Here is that interview. Member states of the World Health Organization have now formally adopted by consensus the world's first pandemic agreement. In your view, what are the greatest benefits to global health cooperation that will be derived from the wide acceptance of this treaty?
I think there's two benefits from a world point of view. I mean, the main one, is specifically if you're a Kiwi, you know, from New Zealand's perspective, is just greater cooperation around surveillance. You know, New Zealand, we're not really a hotspot for some of the viruses that could potentially trigger a global pandemic, but we're only a plane flight away from these places, and so we really rely on other countries to do that surveillance for us, and putting together an international agreement that talks about how we're going to do it, how we're going to cooperate on you know, watching out for potentially pandemic-causing pathogens is really important to us as a country. I think that the kind of the second big benefit from a global perspective is an agreement to collaborate and cooperate much more on the treatments and the vaccines that might be developed during a pandemic. We know that although it was, you know, the vaccine development was impressively fast in the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, the vaccines were being deployed, you know, within a year of that pandemic being declared. The distribution was very unequal. Countries that received the vaccines first were those countries that had the manufacturing capacity, and they tended to be, you know, advanced economies, the United States, Europe. And it took a long time for those vaccines to make their way out into the rest of the world. And so this agreement will really ramp up the sharing of those vaccines so that more of the global supply becomes available to developing countries earlier.
How does the withdrawal of commitment by the United States negatively impact global efforts to prepare for future health crises?
Yeah, I mean, it's really disappointing that the United States has pulled out of this agreement. It pulled out from actually negotiating once the Trump administration came into power. I think one of the things that, you know, there's a couple of reasons why we should be alarmed by that. I mean, first of all, you know, the US is the preeminent scientific country in the world. It's where a lot of the important science gets done. You know, tests get developed in the United States, vaccines get developed there, and so not having the US's cooperation around developing technologies is really disappointing. And I think the second thing is we do know that pandemic viruses do arise in the United States from time to time, and at the moment we're all very nervous about the H5N1 avian influenza, which is circulating in the US, and in particular, it's made it into some of the dairy herds in the United States, and it's spilling over into dairy workers. And that gives this virus the opportunity to recombine with human influenza. And if that happened, we'd very rapidly see a very dangerous influenza virus circulating in the US and potentially spilling over into a pandemic virus. And so the fact that the US is not going to cooperate and, in fact, is shutting down a lot of its public health capacity is a concern.
In what ways have global crises like climate change, food insecurity, and conflict-driven displacement been incorporated into the development of this global health response to future pandemics?
Yeah, I think this new agreement recognises that these things are increasing the risk of global pandemics. We know that you know, there's an enormous number of viruses in the in natural habitat. Bats, for example, there are millions and millions of coronaviruses in wild bat populations that we've never been exposed to as human beings. Now, most of those viruses are not going to cause illness in humans, but it just takes a small fraction of them to figure out how to spread amongst us, spread from human to human, and we've got another pandemic. And so as climate change disrupts the habitat, the natural habitat of animals such as bats, as we encroach on their habitat for agriculture, for example, or deforestation, then we're bringing those viruses closer to us, closer to human society. And we know just from observation that you know, we're increasing the risk of a pandemic virus by 1-2% every year as climate change and deforestation and habitat destruction continues.
Senior lecturer at the University of Canterbury, Dr. Jalal Mohammed, highlighted the exacerbated impact of pandemics on Pacific nations, in particular due to their reliance on international tourists, their fragile health systems, and their historic underinvestment in healthcare. Do you think the treaty as it stands does enough to address the health inequities faced by Pacific populations?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's far enough, but it's a good starting point. You know, we really do need to think of infectious disease as a global problem and not just a problem that you know, affects us as individuals or even as individual countries. It is a global problem. If one part of the world has health vulnerabilities, then all of us do globally. So while I think this treaty is a good starting point, there's still a big role for New Zealand to play in enhancing health, public health in particular, in Pacific nations. And, you know, we did that to a certain extent during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's something I hope that we would look to increase our efforts in over coming decades.
The Royal Commission has made 39 recommendations on pandemic preparedness for implementation by the New Zealand government, ranging from better coordination through a dedicated agency and a specific pandemic plan to preparation across various sectors, including economy, justice and education. What do you believe should be the highest priority for the government in order to prepare for the next pandemic?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is actually that we bring some transparency to what's being done. I think this treaty will help do that because we'll be required to report on our preparedness internationally. At the moment, we don't know what the government is doing in response to the Royal Commission's recommendations. But the report has been made publicly available, but the government's not reporting back on what it's doing. So I think the most important thing at this stage is transparency. We should all be keeping an eye on how ready we are and, you know, holding our politicians to account. You know, we weren't well prepared coming into the COVID-19 pandemic. And although, you know, some experts were aware of that, I think the general public was probably a bit taken aback at our lack of preparedness. And that meant we had to resort to really drastic action like lockdowns. It would be really nice to be in a position to have other options going into the next pandemic. And that'll only really come about if we insist that our politicians are building preparedness and resilience.
Do you have any concerns about the New Zealand public's potential disengagement with government regulations reflective of those carried out during COVID-19?
Yeah, I do think that people have become a bit jaded over what happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, you know, first of all, we responded magnificently in the early stages of the pandemic. You know, people did really well, and we became one of the few countries that were able to eliminate the COVID-19 virus that causes COVID-19. So that was really impressive. But as the pandemic dragged on, we were exposed to more and more misinformation, a lot of which was coming out of the United States with its dysfunctional political system. And unfortunately, you know, some New Zealanders have been heavily influenced by that. And it does worry me that we won't see the same sort of solidarity and community resilience that we had early on in the COVID-19 pandemic should we face up to a pandemic again.
What kind of support are you hoping to receive for the health sector in today's budget announcement from the central government?
Yeah, look, I'm not hugely optimistic. I mean, the messaging has been that that we're in very tight conditions and that we shouldn't expect to see a lot of new investment. But I just, you know, public health pays for itself, really. You know, the more you invest in public health, the less you have to invest in the ambulances at the bottom of the cliff. So I think public health investment is always a good investment. And I would really like to see us doubling down on the public health capacity, especially that we built during the pandemic. We certainly came out of the pandemic with a stronger public health system than we went into it with. And I'm a bit worried that some of that capacity and capability is going to dissipate, and so I'd like to see some investment in our public health infrastructure, although I'm not holding out a lot of hope for this particular budget.
That was Chief Scientist at climate innovation company TOA, Sean Hendy, on the pandemic treaty to improve the global health response.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Today is Budget Day 2025, and Finance Minister Nicola Willis is calling it a no-BS budget that will create growth for New Zealand. I spoke to Susan St. John, Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Auckland Faculty of Business, about the potential social impact of the budget. I started by asking what she expects will be in the budget, particularly based on last year's.
Well, I'm not expecting anything particularly good. I'm expecting more cutbacks and more problems are going to arise in the community because of the nature of this budget. We haven't had any indications that there will be anything positive to affect the people who've been most affected by the decision.
Overall, are low-income families faring better, the same or worse under this government than previously?
Oh, I think it's quite ambiguously worse. You can only just look at how they've been treated with respect to things like benefits and working for families and repayment of student loans, access to accommodation supplement, access to hardship provision, the fact that the food banks have been overwhelmed with demand. I think it's fairly unambiguous that we're seeing quite a crisis within the lowest, worst off portion of the community.
What about government policies aimed at supporting low-income families, like Family Boost?
Well, it's been shown that Family Boost only helped in full a handful of people. It's quite difficult to access, and it's only for those working families who are paying quite high amounts of childcare. So it isn't aimed necessarily at the group I've just been talking about, the ones that have lost work, that have been on benefits for some time, that are in different regions with very high unemployment. Those kind of families have not been touched by family support, a family boost rather.
What do you think is driving these decisions from the government to move away from supporting struggling households?
There seems to be just a one-eyed concentration on achieving fiscal targets like net debt and surpluses and government spending and tax as a proportion of gross domestic product without putting the actual well-being of people at the heart of what they do. And unfortunately, I think we're going to pick up a huge social deficit and a lot of families who are already not struggling who will just find that it's going to be even harder.
The government argues that they have to install these austerity measures because of the economy they inherited from the last government. Do you agree with that line of thinking, that these policies are necessary?
No. Of course, they made it worse for themselves by the tax cuts and the subsidies to the landlords. So let's not forget that. But we must remember we've been through a major pandemic, plus all sorts of other natural disasters, and we've been in a very deep and unpleasant recession that's dragged on and on. And the problem with cutting when you're in such a recession is that you further intensify the depth of that recession. So in my view, we should be much more relaxed about those fiscal targets, realising that we are in a recession, and let the spending on things that support families help us get through that, rather than cutting the very things that are going to help us recover.
And what would you like to see included in today's budget?
I really would like to see that they grapple with the part of the social security budget that affects families, such as working for families, and realises that having fixed thresholds from which families lose the access to this very important payment for their children is far too low. It's been frozen since 2018. And the clawback, once you get over $42,700, is 27% of every extra dollar that a household earns. So it's a draconian clawback. I'd really like them to address that.
I then spoke to Isaac Gunson from the Child Poverty Action Group about the particular impact of the budget on child poverty. I started by asking what he'd like to see in today's budget.
We'd like to see the government take a really aspirational approach to lifting people out of poverty. We want to see things like the Ka Ora Ka Ako school lunches program returned to full funding. We think that's only fair for students who have had to put up with endless issues with this program. We essentially want to see the government acknowledging that people lead really complex, difficult lives, and that helping people who are in poverty and who lead among the most difficult lives in our society, that those people are shown dignity and real respect in the government's financial decisions.
How does this compare to what you're expecting to see today?
Yeah, look, it's interesting, right? So the government has recently passed the Social Security Amendment Bill, which only really looks to up the sanctions on people who aren't meeting their obligations on their benefits. And I just think, you know, these are people going through some of the toughest circumstances that our society can conjure up for them. And what they don't need when they have one form of income left is for a government to be coming in and telling them, oh, well, you know, you're missing this meeting, you're missing that meeting. You know, these are people who might be missing meetings for childcare reasons. They can't afford childcare. They can't afford transport to these meetings. They may not have access to a phone or internet or a plan. There are so many different reasons that people could be missing meetings with MSD, and yet the number of people who are being sanctioned for missing their meetings in the March 2025 quarter was double the March 2024 quarter. It's unacceptable, and my concern is that that attitude that the government has clearly taken towards sanctioning people on benefits is an attitude that's going to be on display throughout the budget and the government's fiscal priorities.
Will any of the pre-budget announcements that we have already heard make a difference to low-income households, particularly child poverty?
The Social Investment Agency approach could work really well, but ultimately our concern is that even that may miss the forest for the trees. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's taking a very, very data-based, sort of granular approach to the social issues that people across Aotearoa face. And our concern is that when you dissect issues to such a granular level, that you're sort of going to miss the forest for the trees. You're going to be trying to solve one problem and missing other overarching problems which could equally be solved.
Does this mean you think something like the Family Boost policy could make a tangible difference or not?
The Family Boost policy could make a tangible difference, but, you know, what we're hearing is that, you know, barely 250 families have accessed the maximum amount when the government promised us it would be around 21,000 who would be eligible. Now, Family Boost doesn't work for a number of reasons, but the biggest one really is that you can only claim the costs back after a certain period of time. So you need to have that money up front and then the government reimburses you. Now, that's not going to help someone in poverty, someone who doesn't have the money for childcare costs. You know, like, it's that alone is a system that has the potential to help, but will only do so with a bit of reworking.
In general, do you think the government is heading in the right direction in terms of confronting child poverty?
No, the government is absolutely not going in the right direction when it comes to dealing with child poverty. We've seen for the third year in a row that child poverty numbers are on the increase through the government's annual data release. We're in a really tricky spot. More children every year are finding themselves in poverty. Now, children, they don't get a say in that. You know, they're busy being children. And what I want to see from the government, what we want to see from the government in this budget, is an aspirational approach that acknowledges how helpless children often are when it comes to their financial circumstances. And seeks to help those children, not penalise their parents.
The Child Poverty Action Group is hosting a post-budget event tomorrow. Is this purely for analysis or is this a call to action?
We will see what comes out of the budget at 2 o'clock. But yes, our event tomorrow is going to be featuring some economic analysis. But we're also going to be hearing from people who are on the ground at the coalface, you know, really working to research these systems that perpetuate poverty in our community, as well as rangatahi, you know, and all the analysis and all the community work in the world is amazing, but it's nothing if we're not hearing from the people that we're trying to help, and those are our young people, our tamariki, our rangatahi across Aotearoa. So I wouldn't describe it as a call to action just yet, but maybe I'll come back to you after 2 o'clock and let you know.
And what are the specific things you'll be looking for when the budget's released at 2 o'clock?
We'll be looking for funding decisions that make clear the government's aspirations to be lifting people out of poverty. Now, that could be the restored Kaora Ta'ako funding. That could be any number of policies that inherently recognise the dignity and respect that people deserve, whether they are experiencing poverty or not.
That was Susan St. John, Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, and Isaac Gunson from the Child Poverty Action Group about the potential social impact of Budget 2025.
That was The Wire.
That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.